What's your favorite fish story? I heard a story of a rather inebriated ice fisherman who went and he began to dig a hole in the ice. And as soon as he got the hole dug, he heard a voice from above saying, "There's no fish there." So he moved on a little ways away, drilled another hole, and he no sooner got it dug, and he heard the same voice. "There's no fish there." He went 50 yards away, drilled another hole, and "No fish are there." And finally he said, "God, is that you?" "No, you idiot. It's the rink manager." "Let me try a second time." The story is told of a gentleman who was out on opening day trout fishing, and he was in a little stream when a gentleman came up, a stranger came up and started a conversation, and he said, "Have any luck?" And the fisherman said, "Oh man, I sure have. Yesterday I caught 10. The gentleman said, "Do you know who I am?" And he said, "No, I don't." "Well, let me introduce myself. I'm the game warden." And the fisherman said, "Do you know who I am?" And the game warden said, "No, I'm the biggest liar in the county." My guess is if you have ever done any fishing, you have either heard and quite possibly told fish stories. They range in the size of the one that got away from the number that you caught, but almost all of us have a fish story. Ernest Hemingway, several years ago, wrote maybe the classic modern fish story, The Old Man and the Sea. And I don't know if you remember from back in school when I'm guessing many of you had to read it, but it's a story of an elderly man who takes upon himself an apprentice, and he goes out 84 consecutive days and catches nothing. Finally, the apprentice parents said, "You can't work with that guy. He doesn't know what he's doing. You need to find a different fisherman." And so on that 85th day, he takes the advice of the apprentice, and he decides to go out a little deeper, and he goes out into the ocean, and he catches this amazing fish. It's the largest fish he's ever seen, and he fights with it for 3 days until he finally is able to get it next to the boat, where he harpoons it and kills it. And it's a marlin larger and longer than his boat. He makes the trek now quite a distance back to the harbor, and because he had killed it, the blood begins to flow, and the sharks come, and they eat all the meat, and the story ends as the old man ends up on the shore with nothing but a skeleton and a head and an amazing story. This morning, I want to go to the most famous fish story of ever. We're going through the 66 books of the Bible, and this morning we come to the one of the minor prophets that I'm quite confident all of you no. In fact, I'm guessing if I asked any of you to come up here and tell this story, you could probably tell the greatest fish story ever told. But this week as I was studying, I don't think it's a fish story. I really do think it's a God story. But before we get to it, I think there's a question that needs to be addressed. Is the story of Jonah real? About the 18th century, there began to be a German rationalism that began to introduce into the church this belief that the supernatural doesn't exist. And for a couple hundred years, the divide over whether or not you accepted Jonah as a real story largely went along the line of, do you believe in the supernatural? But over the last half century, there's been a number of people that have decided that the story of Jonah really is just a parable. It's much like Jesus telling the story of the lost sheep or the prodigal son or the good shepherd. It's a story that wasn't ever intended to be believed as a real story. It's just a story used to make a point. Well, now I want to be careful because Jesus does use parables. And so it isn't that it couldn't be a parable, but is it? Well, I would suggest nothing in the book gives you any hint that it is a parable. When Jesus told parables, he started them off saying, "This is a parable." As you go throughout the Old Testament, you actually find very few parables. But what's even more interesting is that everything in this story is real. The city of Nineveh, you can go today. The remains are just outside the Iraqi city of Mosul. You can go to Joppa. Joppa is actually modern-day Tel Aviv. You can go to almost all of the places, and they are real places. Jonah was a real person. In 2 Kings chapter 14, there's the story of Jeroboam II. He is the king who saw the borders expand of the northern kingdom. And in verse 25, we read that Jeroboam restored the borders of Israel from Lebo Hamath as far as the Sea of Arabah, according to the word of the Lord, the God of Israel, which was spoke by his servant Jonah, the son of Amittai. Jonah was a real person. It would be highly unlikely to take a real person that we can read about other places and make up a story. But for me, the final conclusion is Jesus. Matthew chapter 12, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the teachers of the law come to Jesus and say, Jesus, if you're really Messiah, prove it. We want to see a miracle. Come on, let's be honest. He's done enough of those. He's made the lame to walk, the blind to see, the deaf to hear. He's raised the dead. He's turned water into wine. He's done more miracles than they could begin to even count. So there's no way they hadn't seen enough signs. But Jesus says to them, an evil and adulterous generation seeks a sign, but no sign will be given to you except the sign of the prophet Jonah. For just as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the great fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. It makes no sense to suggest that Jesus took a fictitious story as evidence of his resurrection from the dead. Jesus believed Jonah was in a great fish. But even more, he continues, and he says, the men of Nineveh will rise up at the judgment with this generation and condemn them, for they repented at the preaching of Jonah. And behold, something greater than Jonah is here. Jesus believed Jonah. I guess I will. And so what do we do with the story of Jonah? It says that he was swallowed by this great fish. Now, it's fascinating to me that in Hebrew, the Hebrew were not seagoing people per se. They were mostly landlocked. And so they really didn't have a lot of words. This word could be translated great fish. It could be translated great whale. It could be translated great sea monster. The reality is we really don't know what he's talking about. I don't know if you realize this or not, but if you go back to the height of the whaling industry back in the end of the 19th century, there are numerous stories of people getting swallowed by whales. James Barley was one who was swallowed off the Falkland Islands coast. 2 days later, his shipmates were carving into a large sperm whale. When they noticed the stomach beginning to move, they cut it open and he fell out a chalky white. Did that happen? I don't know. But that's not the point. It says that God provided, some translations said, appeared. I personally think the best way to translate that word is that God had prepared a great fish. Let me just ask this question. If mankind can build a vessel that can hold hundreds of people under the ocean for days on end, do you really think God can't? I don't know what this sea creature was. I don't know if he was a whale, a sea monster, something specifically created for this moment. But let's be honest. If I can get past Genesis 1:1, in the beginning God created, the rest of it's really not that hard to understand. I absolutely believe that the God who spoke the universe into existence has no problem getting a reluctant, wayward prophet to where he needs to go without the use of a submarine. And thus, we begin to figure out when exactly did Jonah die? When did Jonah live, rather? Because it becomes important. If you go back up in that 2 Kings 14 passage, you'll find out that it was during the time of Joash and Jeroboam. Let me bring out my lovely timelines because I like them, and so I hope you do too. But if you were here last week, Paul spoke for me. He took the book of Obadiah. Thank you, Paul. 2 weeks ago, we were looking at the prophet Amos. And Amos said that he was a prophet during the time of Uzziah and Jeroboam. We're told that Jonah was actually during the time of Jeroboam and Joash. And thus, most likely, Jonah would have been the very first of the writing prophets. In fact, it seems highly possible that he actually lived during the time of Elisha. In fact, some have speculated that he had spent time studying under Elisha. If you remember the ministry of Elisha, he had this school of the prophets, and quite possibly Jonah might have been one of those prophets. So why is that important? Well, let me bring this map with me. If you were here a couple weeks ago, I showed this. This is the world kingdoms, and after Israel splits, they begin to see the growth of the Assyrian Empire. In fact, Assyria begins to become quite a dominant power, and by about 800 BC, they basically own the Middle East. But then around 800 BC, they begin to retract. In fact, they begin to crumble as a nation. Pressure from the Babylonians, from the Vans, and in fact, by the time you come to 750, there's the question is whether or not the Assyrian army is going to survive. And then something happens. Historians to this day don't know what happens. But suddenly Assyria turns the corner. And in fact, they begin to regrow. And by the time it comes to 722, they wipe off Israel. They eventually, by about 600 BC, become the dominant power over all of the Middle East. And so the question that I have as someone who enjoys history, is there anything that might have happened in about 750 BC that might have changed the direction of their nation? 750 BC is just about the time a man came out of the mouth of a giant fish and went and preached. I don't know if that's what changed the course of the Assyrians, but I'm left to wonder. But if I can just outline the book, it's Jonah and the storm, Jonah and the fish, Jonah and the city, Jonah and the Lord, and then we're going to come to some quick lessons. But let me just see if I can't try and summarize the book quickly. It begins with the word of the Lord came to Jonah. I fear we go past that too fast. I don't think we often really stop to appreciate the incredible privilege we have to have the word of the Lord. I'm guessing every single one of us here has Bibles at home sitting on a shelf that we rarely take out. If you're like I am, you have given up on hard copies because your eyes don't work. You need big words. And so you use a tablet. I use my phone constantly. We have the word of the Lord constantly bombarding us. But when was the last time you just stopped and contemplated the incredible privilege it is to hear from God? Jonah was called by the Lord to go to Nineveh. Nineveh was not a place that you would want to go. The Assyrians had quite a reputation. They were as violent of a nation as the world has ever seen. They ruled primarily through fear. They would bring and inflict as much personal harm to a person as possible. And if Jonah and Amos overlapped, Jonah already knows that God has prophesied through Amos that the Assyrians are coming for Israel. Would you really care for your enemy? Well, Jonah gets the call, and when Jonah gets the call, he doesn't respond. Isaiah, if you remember Isaiah, the word of the Lord came to Isaiah and said, "Whom shall I send and who will go for us?" And Isaiah says, "Here am I, send me." But not everybody did that. Do you remember Moses? 80 years old, shepherding out on the backside of the desert, enjoying the quiet and solitude, when suddenly there's a bush burning and it starts to speak to him, and it's God, and God says, "Moses, go talk to Pharaoh." And Moses says, I can't do that. I can't talk well. God says, "Who made your tongue?" And so he goes. If you remember Jeremiah was called by God, and Jeremiah says, "No, God, I'm too young." God comes to Jonah and says, "Go to Nineveh." And Jonah decides that he's going to go the exact opposite way. Now, I'm guessing most of us aren't really familiar with the territory, so let me pull up a map. The city of Gath-Hepher is where we're told that Jonah was born, and so his ministry would have been someplace around there. He was called by God to go to the city of Nineveh, which is a 500-mile walk. When was the last time you went for a 500-mile walk? I maybe could have ridden, but we're talking about several months to get there. But instead of going to the north and to the east, we're told that he decides he'd rather go to the city of Joppa. Joppa was the lone port city, and he jumps on a boat, and he decides that he's going to go to the city of Tarshish. Now, we're not 100% sure where Tarshish is, but most people would suggest that the city of Tarshish was as far across the Mediterranean Sea as you could go. It's right where the Mediterranean Sea and the Atlantic Ocean meet. It is, in essence, going to the ends of the world. Kind of foolish. Does God exist at the ends of the earth? When we get to chapter 2, you're going to find out that Jonah is incredibly familiar with God's word. He's going to quote from Psalm 8, Psalm 16, Psalm 30, Psalm 31, Psalm 42, Psalm 142. All in that passage. As you get to chapter 4, he's going to quote from Exodus chapter 32. Surely he knew Psalm 139. In Psalm 139, God says these words through his prophet David: "Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, and if I settle in Tarshish, the far side of the sea. Even there your hand will guide me, and your right hand will hold me fast. You cannot get away from the presence of God. Jonah could not get away from the presence of God. And thus, as Jonah goes, there's suddenly this incredibly storm. It says that the Lord sent a great wind. Most of us don't enjoy storms, but storms oftentimes teach us something. In fact, the reality is that too often we get so busy with life that we don't always have time to stop and contemplate what's truly important. Sometimes we need a good storm in our life to get us to slow down. God sends a storm, a great wind, and such a violent storm arose that the ship was threatened to break up, and all the sailors were afraid, and each one cried out to his own God, and they threw the cargo into the sea to lighten the ship. But Jonah had gone below deck, where he lay down, and he fell into a deep sleep. Then the captain went to him and said, "How can you sleep? Get up and call for your God. Maybe your God will take notice of us, and we will not perish." Then the sailors said to each other, "Come, let us cast lots to find out who is responsible for this calamity." And they cast the lots, and it fell on Jonah. And so they have all these questions. "Tell us, who's responsible for making all this trouble for us? What do you do? Where did you come from? What is your country? From what people are you?" He answers, and he says, "I'm a Hebrew, and I worship..." That's a pretty generous word, if you ask me. "I worship the Lord, the God of heaven and earth, who made the sea and the land." This terrified them, and they asked him, "What have you done?" They already knew he was run away from the Lord because he had already told them. The sea was getting rougher and rougher, and so they asked him, "What should we do to make the sea calm down for us?" And Jonah's response, "Pick me up, throw me into the sea, and it will become calm. I know that it is my fault that this great storm has come upon you." Is that the right answer? "God, I want nothing to do with you, so much so I want to be dead." Let's be honest. It's a violent storm that the sailors don't think they're going to survive. In the middle of the Mediterranean Sea, there's no hope that Jonah is going to swim to shore. This is a death wish. Kill me. These pagan sailors have more compassion than Jonah will. Instead, the men did their best to row back to the land, but they could not, for the sea grew even wilder than before. Then they cried to the Lord. Remember, anytime you see the word Lord in all capitals, that is the covenantal name of God with Israel. That is Jehovah. "Jehovah, please do not let us die for taking this man's life. Do not hold us accountable for killing an innocent man." That we already decided he wasn't innocent. "Don't let us kill this innocent man, for you, O Lord, have done as you please." Then they took Jonah and they threw him overboard. And the raging sea grew calm. And they suddenly realized there's something much worse than death. There is a God who controls the winds and the waves. And we have just witnessed his presence. I would suggest that the sailors were way more terrified at that moment than during the storm. And thus they fall on their faces. They offer sacrifice to the Lord and they make vows to him. I don't really know for sure what the sailors prayed. I don't know for sure what was in the heart of the sailors. But I wonder, have you ever come face to face with a God who controls the winds and the waves? I fear sometimes we think of God as our best buddy, the man upstairs. He's way more than that. He is a God to be feared, but a God who loves and offers each of us life. Not because we deserve it, not because we could possibly ever earn it, but because he is an amazingly gracious God. He spares the sailors. And I've often wondered, I don't know for sure what's happened. I don't know if they saw this. It is interesting, both the Assyrians and the Egyptians have ancient myth traditions of a large sea creature vomiting up a man on shore. I don't know if they saw this. I've often wondered, did the sailors get to see Jonah gulped up by the whale, or did they just watch him bob a little while and go. And he began to sink. I don't know, but the Lord provides this great fish to swallow Jonah. And Jonah was inside the fish for 3 days and three nights. And then chapter 2 comes along. And that word from probably should be translated then. I don't want to make a whole lot out of it, but I think it's fascinating that there is the very real possibility that Jonah didn't get it right away. You ever not get it right away? Does God have to sometimes work a little while? I mean, what exactly are the accommodations like inside the stomach of a whale, a sea monster? I don't know, but I can't imagine that it isn't one of the smelliest places you've ever been, one of the hottest places you've ever been, one of the most inhospitable places you've ever been, laying in this gastric acid, wondering what's next. See, one of the struggles you have with a familiar story is you know how it works out. Jonah didn't. Jonah had to have been wondering, all right, God, am I just going to slowly rot to death in this whale? Is this the end for me? At some point, Jonah finally gets it. We don't really have time, or we're not going to take the time to look at chapter 2, but I would strongly encourage you to go back and look at it. It is one of the most beautiful prayers found anywhere in the Bible. And John Piper preached a sermon on it that I was listening to, and he makes some amazing points. Do you realize that Jonah prays to God in spite of his guilt? See, sometimes we think, God, I blew it, I can't come to you. No, that's when God wants you to come to him. In fact, he's even willing to come to you when you're already in the middle of your judgment. He was already experiencing the judgment that he deserved for his sin. And yet, even in these incredible, horrible circumstances, God heard his prayer. And it was just in the nick of time. In verse number 7, it makes this statement, while I was fainting away, I remembered the Lord, and my prayer came to thee into thy holy temple. As I was about to breathe my last breath, you showed up. One of my favorite quotes goes back many years. Somebody said it to me when I was going to India trying to raise money. He made this comment that God is never late, but rarely early. In the nick of time, God comes. And it was his desire to teach Jonah gratitude. I'm convinced verses 8 and 9 are the best illustration of the gospel in all of the Old Testament. It says, those who cling to worthless idols. My guess is that when most of us hear that word idol, we say, I don't have any idols. I spent a year in India, and you could go to almost anybody's house, and they would have a god shelf in which they would have a place that they would put their favorite gods. And they had little graven images of all these bizarre-looking creatures that they worship. And you say, I don't do that. One of the sermons I was listening to was by a pastor out in New York City, and he defined idolatry this way. Anything that you would rather die than give up. I can't live without fill in the blank. That's an idol. I can't live without my spouse, my children. I can't live without my possessions or income. I can't live without my prestige, my position. What is it that you, if it were taken from you, you would lose all interest in life? That's an idol. In fact, he went as far to suggest that you cannot break the last 9 commandments without first breaking the first commandment. To love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy mind. Can you honestly say that it doesn't matter what God takes from you as long as you have him? One of my favorite stories back during the time of the Exodus, God finally is frustrated enough with Israel and he says to Moses, go on, you guys just go on into the promised land, but I'm not going with you. And Moses says, if you will not go with me, I will not leave. Worthless idols forfeit the grace that could be theirs. Can a loving God really condemn people to an eternity of torment? May I suggest all he's doing is giving them what they ask for. I don't want you, God. I don't want anything to do with you. I don't want anything to do with you. They jump over hurdle after hurdle. I don't want you. I don't want you. I don't want you. Okay. Then you don't have to have me. They forfeit the mercy that is available. And my favorite word
in perhaps the whole Bible. But I, with a song of thanksgiving, will sacrifice to you what I have vowed I will make good, because salvation comes from the Lord. I don't ever want to presume in a room this size that everybody has gotten to that place where they recognize their need for a Savior and have come in just childlike faith and turned from their sins and placed their faith in the finished work of Jesus on the cross. But if you haven't done that, there is nothing more important you will ever do. There's nothing that will ever rival that decision. And it is my prayer, my plea, that you figure out what it means. Salvation comes from the Lord. Come talk to me. Come talk to somebody. But there is no more important decision. And Jonah, in the belly of a whale, recognizes salvation comes from the Lord alone. And we come to chapter 3, and in chapter 3, we suddenly are introduced to what I would suggest is one of the most beautiful verses in all the Bible. Then the word of the Lord came to Jonah a second time. Aren't you glad God doesn't give up on you after your first or second or hundredth or thousandth mistake? None of us are perfect. All of us are flawed. And yet God is amazingly patient with each of us. And God comes to Jonah a second time and he says, go to the great city of Nineveh and proclaim to it the message I will give you. And so Jonah obeys the Lord of the word and he went to Nineveh. Now, Nineveh was an important city. A visit required 3 days. There's lots of talk. Some have suggested that what the great city is a phrase meaning the greater metropolitan area, much like Minneapolis or St. Paul, is not just a single city, but multiple cities. And history does give the suggestion that Nineveh was made up of a number of small cities. Others have said, no, it takes 3 days because you stop at every street corner to talk. I don't know what the 3 days means, but in 3 days, he goes around and he begins to preach this eight-word message. Some of you were hoping for an eight-word message this morning. Sorry. In Hebrew, it's actually only 5 words. And I would suggest it is about as dispassionate a sermon as has ever been given, because the preacher didn't want anybody to listen. He wanted them destroyed. They were his enemies. And yet he goes from house to house. 40 days, and Nineveh will be overthrown. And then something that he could never have expected to happen. The Ninevites believe God. And they declare a fast, all of them, from the greatest to the least, put on sackcloths. And when the news reached the king of Nineveh, he rose from his throne. He took off his royal robes. He covered himself with sackcloth, and he sat down in the dust. Then he issued a proclamation in Nineveh. By decree of the king and his nobles, do not let any man or beast or herd or flock taste anything. Why does he not let the animals eat? If you don't feed an animal for a few days, they're going to start to cry. It's going to give to that whole song, that sound of mourning. Do not let them eat or drink, but let man and beast be covered with sackcloth. Let everyone call urgently on God. Let them give up their evil ways and their violence. Who knows? God may yet relent and with compassion turn from his fierce anger so that we will not perish. And when God saw what they did and how they turned from their evil ways, he had compassion, and he did not bring upon them the destruction he had threatened. And Jonah was glorious. Whoopee! Don't you kind of wish Jonah ended after chapter 3? That we end with this very verse, that everyone turns. It's not where we end. Chapter 4, you go and you see that Jonah was greatly displeased and became angry. And he prayed to the Lord, "Oh Lord, isn't that what I said when I was still at home? This is why I was so quick to flee to Tarshish. I knew that you are a gracious and compassionate God, slow to anger and abounding in love, a God who relents from sending calamity. Now, oh Lord, take away my life, for it is better for me to die than to live." Jonah couldn't bring himself to be thankful that his enemies had turned to God and God had forgiven them. very quickly then, if I can just share a couple lessons that at least I have learned. You cannot read the book of Jonah without seeing that God is awesome. The waves listen to him. The winds listen to him. A worm and a vine listen to him. In fact, it's kind of interesting that the only person in the entire book that doesn't listen to him is Jonah. I don't know what that means, but as you read through the book, God is an awesome God. When was the last time you thanked him? I know that Thanksgiving doesn't come around till November, but can I challenge you to do something this week? Would you purpose to begin each day with a simple prayer of gratitude for something specific? It's really easy for me to simply say, God, thank you, and go on. But I'm convinced one of the greatest tools that we have in our arsenal against greed, against lust, against so many of the sins, is simply to take the time to contemplate all that God has given us. In fact, I'm convinced that one of the greatest problems in American society today is because we have so much, we want more. And we never stop to say thank you for the things that we have. I would hope that you could come up with 7 things to give thanks for. But I want to challenge you to take a few moments and begin each day with a simple thank you. The second lesson that I don't think you can miss is that God does give his grace to anyone who turns from his sin and trusts in him. I don't think it's a coincidence that God chose the Assyrians. I could, and was somewhat tempted to tell you some of the stories, but if you're interested in gore, go read about the Assyrians. There's never been a gorier people than the Assyrians. They were as wicked and as evil as any group that's ever lived. And God says, I want them. My guess is that some of you have been tempted to say, I would share the gospel with my neighbor, but there is no way they would ever listen. Really, they're worse than the Assyrians? Anyone who's willing to turn from their sin and rush to the open arms of God will experience his forgiveness and his salvation and his promise of an eternity in his presence. But I'm convinced the point of the book, in fact, Jonah is a unique book. There's only 2 books in the entire Old Testament that ends as Jonah does. It ends with a question. God comes to Jonah and says, why are you angry? And then he grows a vine and shades him. I don't know if you've ever been in the Middle East. When I was in India, I had a good friend who grew up in Iran, just not terribly far from Mosul in Iraq. And he shared with me that it wasn't uncommon during the hot season for the temperatures to get to be 130 degrees, that during the heat of the day, if you walked on the sand, it would either burn your feet or melt your shoes, that you just couldn't go out. And Jonah is in this heat, and God provides a vine that provides shade. It had to have been glorious. And then the worm dies. Worm comes along, the vine dies, and he's upset. And God said to Jonah, do you have a right to be angry about the vine? I do! I'm angry enough to die! But the Lord said, you've been concerned about this vine, though you did not tend it or make it. It sprang up overnight and died overnight. But Nineveh has 120,000 people who cannot tell their right hand from their left. That's a Hebrewism for saying little children. The average society has about 1/5 of kids that are under the age of being able to read or write. So 600,000 people in Nineveh. They have many cattle. Should I not be concerned about that great city? What's Jonah's answer? We don't know. Some would like to suggest that Jonah finally gets his act together. He repents. And that's why we have the book of Jonah. That this is his way to make amends for the rebellion that he'd experienced. It's possible. But I don't think that's the point. I think the point is, do you care? I'm convinced that the primary purpose of Jonah is written to all of us to ask, do you really care about those around you? Or is comfort more important? I have to be honest. It's really easy to get caught up in this world, to enjoy a night at home with nothing to do, to enjoy my family, my friends, and never get around to talking to my neighbor who's never heard Christ and is headed for an eternity apart from him. Do I care? Do you care? Do you really care? I'm not just talking about the answer you give to the pastor after the end of the service. I'm saying, do you construct your life in such a way that you go out of your way, maybe even get a little uncomfortable, to share the love that you enjoy with someone else? I want to challenge you to do something. Would you be willing to begin the day thanking God for one thing and then asking him to lay upon your heart one person? I know that you can't reach 600,000 people. I know that our church can't reach 300 and however many million are in America. But is it really too much to ask for one? Just one person that I would have the courage to go and share the love of Christ? Or is the story going to be, sorry, God, I'm more interested in my comfort. I'd rather die than do that. Do we care? Father, we bow in your presence this morning, and I thank you for the story of Jonah. I thank you for the convicting question it has for me. God, I thank you that someone was willing to share with me the good news of what Jesus did on the cross for my sins, that they were willing to invite me to a life with you. God, I pray that all of us would be willing to take that uncomfortable step. God, I know that we can't save anyone, we can't force anyone, but we can certainly share your love with others. God, I pray that we would be willing to become a little uncomfortable, to maybe even make some sacrifices to share your love with a world that desperately needs it. Thank you, for it is in your Son's holy and precious name we pray.